Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
You know, I'm used to all this thing where people, because there was three of the brothers before, and like they got us all confused with each other. But you guys throw in the wrinkle that you got a wife involved. Yeah. Both these guys are identical twins.
Yeah.
And they used to one have a beard and one not, so you could... But now they both have beards.
They look exactly the same now.
That's right. That's why Alex wore the hat for us today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Nordy Pod. I'm Pete Nordstrom, president of Nordstrom, and your host for this podcast. Join me as I take you on an honest, authentic journey through our company and introduce you to many of the fascinating people in my life, one episode at a time. All right, today on the Nordy Pod, we are talking to the founders and operators of a brand, Faraday. And you may or may not be familiar with it. We sell it at Nordstrom. It's been successful and growing for us. But the reason I thought it'd be a great idea to have them on the podcast is one of the things I get to do is interact with different brands, and especially if they've come to Seattle and have a meeting. And so recently, Alex and Mike came to Seattle and we had a meeting. I got a chance to sit in on that and just listen about their story and then our growth plans together and how we are partnering. And I just thought, this is an interesting brand. These are interesting people. And I think people would like hearing about it. So Alex, Mike, and Carrie, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Honored.
So probably the best way to go here is say, okay, we got three people here. Let's just make a distinction up front of who everybody is and what they do. So who wants to start?
So I'm Mike Faraday, and I oversee the creative side of the brand. I'll go deep, Pete. I'll go real deep.
You got to leave time for your family here on the other side of the table.
Okay. Yeah. So after college, was lucky enough to get a job at Ralph Lauren. You know, worked my way up there, kind of like knew I want to start this company from a long time back, and I'll give the out story later. But Ralph Lauren was a great ground for me to really see this, you know, a massive organization for sure. But the little pieces I worked on did feel kind of like startup-y and small brandy, which I think was helpful when we launched this thing.
All right. So I'm Mike's brother, Alex, and I am the CEO of the business. So I run the day-to-day operations, sales, anything and everything that's sort of like the back end of the business. And before this, I worked in finance. I started in investment banking out of college, and then I worked for a private equity firm as an investor for 5 years. But honestly, since the first job I got when I was 22, I told everyone one day I was going to start a clothing company with my twin brother, Mike. And here we are today.
I'm Carrie. I'm also known as Alex's wife. Co-founder as well. And my background had been in human rights and social justice. So I was a lawyer by trade, went to Pepperdine School of Law. And yes, I met Alex first day of college. I remember him talking. He wanted to have a clothing company one day. And I said, cool, dude. And now here we are. So I'm chief impact officer.
Where did you go to college?
We both went to Yale. Both were jocks. Okay. He played football. I played lacrosse.
Alex was the ball boy of Carrie's lacrosse team.
Yes, he was.
All right. Well, so then talk about the origins of the brand, how this all started. And it sounds like it goes back farther than as adults. You decided here's a business venture for us.
Mike, why don't you give your
story? I'll go way back for you, Pete. So I was a young boy, probably 7, 8 years old is when it started. But I just realized I loved clothing. Like back to school shopping was the greatest day of the year for me. And I hung on to it. My dad had good style, so I obviously like was able to watch him. But when I sat down to write my college essay, you know, one of the questions was like, what if you would start a company when you're older, what would it be? And I literally sat and wrote this company. So ever since that day, the company was actually called Coast to Curb in my initial college essay.
So you were going like surf skate, trying to combine these
things?
Yeah,
I mean, we grew up in a beach town on the Jersey Shore. You know, about 60 miles from New York City. So it's like this instant confluence between like beach town and New York City. Like you have them both in your life. And, you know, summertime's the shore with our families, like, you know, we had a big old house and we would come down and it was like, that style was I love that style. But then we actually moved to New York City in high school. So I was like seeing different things. And I remember my dad took me to Bergdorf's one day. And I remember feeling like a Laura Piano sweater for the first time, cashmere sweater. And it just like blew my mind. I was like, what is this? Why do my clothes not feel like this? And then when I started like trying to have my own style, I couldn't really pull it together. So when I sat down to write this essay, it was like, I wanted to create this style that like merged this beach life with clothes you could wear in the city that still felt like casual and kind of current. So I put that on paper and then Alex and I were like, we're doing this. And honestly, like I went to college at Washington University in St. Louis. I majored in fashion design. I also played sports there. I was a basketball player there, but you know, my college career was sewing clothes, cutting patterns. It was different.
So Alex, maybe you talk about a little bit, you know, your brother had a real clear vision and everything. So are you getting in on this because you felt like a brotherly obligation, or how did it dovetail with your personal interest too?
Probably started as a brotherly obligation. I think there's the weird thing about being a twin is that you're connected at the hip for most of your life. So the initial thing was like, if you're going to do it, like I'm going to do it with you. And I think some of it had to do with the nature of our relationship. Like I was sort of the big brother kind of taking care of Mike. He was sort of like the free spirited artist, you know, everything was fun, everything was great. And I sort of always had to like watch out for him. And so it wasn't necessarily my passion, but it became my passion because Mike was going to do it. And I thought the idea of owning our own business together would one day be a dream.
And was your perspective of being in finance and private equity, did it give you some view about what it would take to bootstrap up a company like this and make it work?
Yeah, if I look back, I did it for two reasons. One, the most important reason I did it was, I remember asking someone a mentor of mine in college, like, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing. What should I do? And the initial comment was make as much money as you possibly can because these businesses eat money. And then I was like, where can you make the most money as a young kid? And it was sort of in finance. So that was like the first thing. And then the second step was it's actually, you know, getting into the investment banking, private equity world, a great place to learn really fast. So when Mike made the call when we were about 30 years old and said, you know, Alex, it's time, I felt like we were sort of ready to go.
Well, I tell you, I can relate a little bit to what you're talking about. Wanting to work with your brother. I get asked this all the time, like, how did it come to be that my brothers and I work in the business? And when I was in college, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I knew a lot about, you know, our business. Obviously, I'd sold shoes and worked during the summer. I like my brothers. I like my dad. I like the idea of being able to work with them. But, you know, we didn't all agree on everything and we're different. But there was a bond and a connection there that allow the sum of the parts to be more, right? It's like there were three of us that had a similar goal and mindset and allowed it to be better than any one of us could have been individually. Does that ring true for you guys too? You felt like working together? And obviously I want to throw Carrie into this too. Was there a sense of your like-minded purpose and vision around this allowed it to work better because there were three of you, not just one?
100%. I always joke that we each only have a third of a brain, but together, it's like we're Captain Planet. I don't know how people start businesses without, you know, to start a successful business, you have to be doing everything at once. So to be able to have Mike own creative, Alex own business and finance, me own impact, sustainability, brand, it makes it so much easier for us to succeed. And not to mention Alex and Mike's mom designs all of our stores. So she's an interior decorator.
Oh,
so there's really four of us. And I think the other thing is, you know, starting a business can be so isolating. It's head down. So to be able to do it with people you love makes it feel a little bit less lonely. So, yeah, you know, I look at friends who have brands and it's I don't know how you don't do it without a big enough team.
Okay, so what year was this? You said, okay, we're going to do this thing. Here we go.
So 2012, I quit my job at Ralph Lauren. I called Alex. I was driving through the mountains of Southern California in the desert after New Year's, and a song came on And I remember like just this vision happened and I called Alex. I'm like, we're doing this. That day I get back, I'm telling my boss, I'm quitting my job and let's go. And so I spent about a year kind of prepping this thing, like building the brand from the scratch, like getting the initial prototypes going, kind of getting us ready to launch. While Carrie and Alex, they kept their jobs and then they got married towards the summer of that year. Then we all moved in together. And then basically when we launched about a year and change later on a website, we just basically had a website. But it was good because Carrie, as a lawyer, came from human rights. So she was able like just deal with law stuff. Alice could figure out how to do like operations. I kind of had to take over production and design because I had, you know, kind of was one full thing. But we were all dangerous enough in our own way to like do the business and then trust each other that the other, that we were all going to figure out how to do it together. And then my mom, she was also in the beginning and we didn't know how to ship anything from a warehouse. So she was like, I don't know, I'll rent a storage facility and I'll figure out how to like ship e-commerce boxes. And she just like built in a small DC, like the size of a, you know, a 14 by 14, you know, storage bin. And we shipped product that my mom did for us in the beginning. So it was pretty rad.
So how long was it that was literally just you guys and perhaps your mother? I mean, when did you actually start hiring employees and it became real?
Yeah. So I would say for the first couple years, it was still really small. So it was the four of us and we had a couple people that we brought on early on, but it was pretty much the four of us for the first couple years and doing everything, you know, it was like all of a sudden vacations and Christmas dinners, like we're just talking about the business. Thanksgiving, I was doing email blasts for Black Friday at the table, you know, like it was cool.
We definitely went all in because we had to.
And I think we quickly realized like, holy cow, like this business does eat money. Like, we have to figure out how to make this thing successful because this is all we got.
When was the first time you actually sold something?
April of 2013, we launched with a range of just bathing suits for men's and women's. So we made sustainably minded board shorts and bikinis out of recycled plastic water bottles, recycled polyester. And that's all we had. So, you know, 10 bathing suits for men, 10 bathing suits for women's. We had a website and then we built the mobile store. That looks like it's like a mix between a little house, like a tiny house and a trailer. And we traveled the country with it for the first 9 months of the brand, going from city to specialty store to concert venue and just like hustled to sell bathing suits out of a traveling store.
And so at that point, was it 100% direct to customer? Did you have any wholesale right at the beginning?
It was 100% direct to customer on the website and then on this cool, weird traveling store.
Man, it's like the Partridge Family. And you guys go out there in the bus and make it happen. It's pretty good.
We were a band. We were a clothing band, you know, not a clothing brand.
But I think some of it was like our, I think we fell in love when we started the business with this building concept. Like, how do you get it off the ground? How do you, you know, we had this thing where like, all right, we can stay in business the first year if we make $1,000 in revenue a day. That was like, we did this math equation and then we just did everything we could to get $1,000 in revenue.
How many shirts do we need to sell? Pull over. We're like opening up the store.
And within this whole story, we decided in the summer of 2013 to drive this mobile store to Las Vegas to go to the trade show, the Project trade show. And actually two people from your team came in, put a small order in for our bathing suits. And that was kind of the beginning of our relationship with Nordstrom that happened kind of that first selling season.
So, hey, Carrie, can you tell me a little bit about the brand ethos? And is that something that you guys had really aligned on early on, or did that evolve as this thing got going?
I would say we were pretty aligned. I think the fact that, you know, it's our last name means that the integrity in which we do things is so important. It's literally our name on the fabric and on the garments. So ensuring that we were using low impact materials from the get-go, Mike was great at focusing on organic cotton, recycled materials.
I want to pause on that for a second. At the time, did that feel like that was going to be part of the brand DNA and a strategic advantage that you had this authentic sustainability thing going? Or is it just what you did because you thought it was the right thing to do? Or was it actually part of your brand ethos?
I mean, we had it in our core pillars for sure, but it was just, duh, like we
do our best to recycle and compost already. So it's just a part of what we do.
So I'm wondering, if you're a new employee to Faherty or if you're a new customer, what do they learn about the brand that gives it a personality and a point of view?
I would say, you know, we have six core values that are embedded into the brand and internally, but it's really about making things better and spreading good vibes. And when we talk about making things better, we don't only mean from a product tactile perspective, but also how are we building communities? What is our philanthropic giving strategy? Who are our partners? One thing that we're really passionate about is ending appropriation in fashion. So any of our prints that look Native inspired are actually designed by a Native artist. I know Nordstrom, you all celebrated Native American Heritage Month a year ago and featured some of the products of the designers that we work with, which was so incredible. But yeah, I think our ethos is like, everything we do, how can we make sure it's the best that it can be from a 360 approach? And how are we spreading good vibes and imbuing in this feeling of life's great moments?
So, Alex, how did that dovetail in then with a business plan? So you've got all the aesthetic of what you're trying to do. You got a lot of the subjective qualities of what a brand is. Talk about how it evolved to what it is today, where you actually, you know, you're selling direct to customer, you're wholesale, you're retailers. You got a lot going on here. So can you talk about that a little bit?
So part of, I think, the benefit and also caused some lot of work once we started was, you know, as coming from the private equity background and spending all these years sort of studying business models of, you know, the best brands that have existed, whether that's luxury or fashion, they all had, you know, this tag, you know, the omni-channel business, right? Like they wholesale was a very important part of their business. You know, stores were an important part of their business. And obviously online was a newer venture for a lot of brands, but it was, you know, super important to the future. And so we took sort of, I think, an old school approach to like, what have the best brands used to build their businesses? And it was a combination of all three. So our initial business plan had us, you know, having a business that was a third retail, a third wholesale, and a third online.
But was it at that point, I mean, you guys came up in an era where that was almost running against the current a little bit. The whole premise was, we're just going direct to customer. We don't need those guys. We're just going to have our own thing. But you guys really did build a multi-leg stool, which, by the way, is the most successful way to do it. We interact with all these brands too. Hard to go it alone, right?
It's very hard to go it alone. And it definitely was, if you talk to investors or you know, new entrepreneurs that were starting ventures, you know, wholesale, you know, you don't control your brand. Department stores can take advantage of you. You know, there's also these like reasons not to do wholesale. And we saw it firsthand because we were the ones that were, you know, what did I do for the first 3 years? I had a suitcase of clothes and I was traveling the country, meeting with stores, meeting with store owners, meeting with buyers, spending time on, you know, on store floors on Saturdays, you know, for trunk shows. And I saw the power of meeting the customer where they're at in places that they love to shop. So, you know, whether that's a Nordstrom or a store in Memphis, Tennessee that carries Faherty, like we just didn't have the money to buy those customers. And we also found so much value in being connected to other brands in these stores. And then I think the retail, opening up retail stores, I think some of it was just something when we built the plan, like we needed like an experience where Faherty could come to life because it has this sort of coastal, beachy, chill vibe. And so what we decided to do is we built a little store in New York City in 2014 in where our offices were, like in the front. It was like on Thompson Street in Greenwich Village, a little like 400 square foot storefront. You know, there's really no shopping over there. We were one of a couple stores, but that's where mom came in handy. Was mom, you know, mom was an interior designer. And so we could just say, mom, can you just sort of figure out what a Faherty store looks like and is? And obviously moms can figure out just about anything for their sons.
Yeah.
And so that was the introduction to our store concept. And it took about 3 years for the store to like do some business, but it started doing some business. And then we knew we wanted to do something bigger and more prominent. And as surfer kids from New Jersey, our favorite place to go was Malibu, California. And so we would always go there on spring break to Southern California. So early on, you know, three, four years in, we decided to open this sort of flagship store in Malibu, California, and rent was really high, more build out expense than we could have ever thought. We took a big risk, but we knew if we could make it to Malibu, which was this sort of like
magical place that we grew up going to that, you know, this would be something special for the brand. So we opened up the store, ended up being a big success. And, you know, kind of the retail story of Faherty was off and running.
So one thing I'm thinking about when you start a company like that, everyone's got their role. The one thing you guys really haven't talked about, but it sounds like you had to all play a role in that is someone's got to go out and sell this to people. Was that all just what you did instinctively?
That's what we did from the beginning. So going back to that first year, you know, it was hand-to-hand combat. You know, we got to sell $1,000 worth of product a day to make it. And we would do anything and everything. I mean,
you wouldn't take price tags off of your clothes. And if somebody said, I liked your shirt, you would literally take it off your back. Like, sold. You want it? Give you a deal.
Like, we're selling at like music festivals to people by like the urinal. Like, we have, you know, like we pulled over on the side of the road on the PCH one day to take a break. And like two cars pulled up behind us and we opened it up and sold stuff to people. So it was like, I don't know. It just started. That was it. We had to sell this inventory. So from day one, we needed to do it. I mean, I even think about like when we had I had my first little studio, I'd be like, as soon as I got some inventory, I'd send out email blasts, Facebook invites, like come to the studio, like come check out our new stuff. And I was just like selling, you know, I'd get a case of beer and sell stuff to our friends. And then once the business got going, I mean, we just divide and conquer. It'd be like, all right, you go, Alex, you go to Memphis. All right, Carrie, you go down to Birmingham. All right, Mike, you go to Charleston. Okay, you guys go hit those trade shows. Okay, great. You know, and that was from like a wholesale perspective. And then at the same time, we get home, you know, our store was where our office was. So most of the time, Alex was like on the selling floor. Like as soon as people walked in, he'd run down. I mean, I remember like he'd look to see who was in the store. Because like his office was above it and he could look down, you know, and he'd like see if it was a possible person. You could just hear him go and just like give him the spiel, land the person. And definitely sales culture was something that was like happened to us because it needed to.
Yeah, I think that's super fascinating. I mean, it's, you know, we talk about that around here too. It's like always be selling.
Yeah, I mean, every vacation we go on is near a store. It's like if we're going on vacation, we will also be in the store on Saturdays selling garments.
And our kids know, like they know that, yep, going to the Faherty store on Saturday. That's what we're doing.
Okay, so I can only imagine other people would have this question too. So this all sounds very idyllic. It's like, here's this family, we're doing this thing, we're bootstrapping this up, but it is happening and it's growing. Do you have a story about at some point where you bumped into a level of disagreement and contention, you guys had to figure out how to sort that out?
But that just brought to mind the first thing was the first couple of years, money got really, really tight. And so Carrie would put we all lived together. So Carrie had our apartment on Airbnb. So we would just take whatever hit we could get on Airbnb.
So you had to go take off? Like, uh-oh, we got...
Oh, yeah. It'd be like 11 o'clock at night and they'd be like, okay, let's go home. And I was like, well, here's the thing. Someone from Argentina is staying in our home right now. But it helped us pay rent. So that was
helpful.
So we
would get in our car and drive to my mom's house.
We drive all the way to the Jersey Shore.
And so that was like, you know, Airbnb was very helpful as like side cash to get through those first few years. And then your second point on disagreements and conflict and challenges. I think, you know, if I look back on those early years, like it was just one ball of stress and anxiety of stuff, learning how to deal with a world and a life where stuff just went wrong every day and you just couldn't control it. So I don't think we were really good about having trust in each other. Going back to Carrie's initial comment of like the trust you have in your family went a long way. But we definitely had to deal with a lot of stress.
So what point was there a moment where it's like, this is real, this is happening, and it's a thing?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it earlier. Definitely one of the moments was when we opened up this store in Malibu and it worked. And we had this event at the store on a Saturday in the summer. And, you know, we did $20,000 in sales or something like that, which was a huge number for us, you know, as a new up and coming brand. Then that sort of, you know, that was like a honeymoon and then there was a slog and then COVID hit. And obviously that was a, you know, crazy year. There definitely was a moment in the fall of 2020 when our business really started to soar and we saw that there was this digital word of mouth for our website business that really started to happen at the end of 2020. I think that was a huge moment.
But it took 7 years. Every year for the first 7 years, we were like, are we going to make it? Are we going to make it? So I think sometimes people say like, oh, wow, you guys grew so fast. And we did. But the majority of that time was yearly reassessment of, are we going to make it?
So when I'm looking at our business together, and it's a real northeasterly thing that just keeps going like this. Can you talk about what it's like to be a partner with Nordstrom specifically, but even beyond that, choosing partners and how you go through that process? Because you guys clearly don't sell everybody.
Yeah, we definitely have created a product line that is quality first. So whatever it takes for me to develop the best possible fabric, make it in the best possible construction, is sort of the price of the garment. Some people, you know, would be like, man, Faraday's so overpriced, you know, but then if they actually get the garment on, they're like, damn, I get it. And so I think that's a lot of just like, our partners understand the quality of the product, and therefore we're a good match because they're also quality first people. So really it's that sort of relationship there where it's like, yeah, we could have the flashiest, coolest brand in the world, but at the end of the day, the customer sees it on a table in a sea of other stuff. And why do they pick Faraday? Because they feel the fabric, they look at the color, they look at the buttons, they look at the sort of construction, like, wow, this is a quality made garment and I want to wear this.
You know, I've had that personal experience with your guys' brand. You know, after we met, well, it was about a month or so ago, Christmas came up and one of my friends was in the store shopping for her husband. And I said, I'll come down to meet you. I'll help you out here. Like, and I had, you know, you guys were nice enough to give me a shirt, which I wear all the time. That's great. And I said, you know, you should try this Faraday brand. Check this out. And she touched it. It was like, oh, this is really nice. I think my husband will like it. And sure enough, I heard from him after Christmas. He goes, man, I really like those clothes you helped my wife pick out. I really like that Faraday shirt you've got me. So you're right about that. I mean, there's an intrinsic value that goes with it in a very tactile way, right? It goes way beyond the transaction. If someone could actually feel and touch this, you know, and then try it on, you really got something going for you.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. Obviously I've always had this, we have this dream that like our brand helps to like transport people to, we call it life's great moments. But, you know, a lot of our brand visuals kind of revolve around travel, hanging out with your friends, that vibe. And I think it's like trying to create cloth that feels a way that then you put it on and you're like, you know what? Like, I know I got to go to this meeting and it's going to stink, but you know what? I look down, I'm like, my Faraday shirt feels pretty damn good. And you know what? That meeting's not going to suck so much.
I should wear your shirt to more meetings so I have less sucky meetings.
Exactly. Totally. You know, and continue to sort of inspire that with the way our stores look or the products we make, that you kind of can put them on. You're like, wow, there's something different about this. And it's just made my day a little better.
And I think to your initial point, Pete, on, you know, our business together with Nordstrom and, you know, how it's just been a really good, just steady growth. I think it has to do with, you know, Faraday as a brand. I think we think of our style as timeless and classic. Like, we're not chasing trends. You know, we're not chasing, you know, trying to, Mike said, like, be the flashiest brand. And, you know, with quality being there and people willing to pay for quality, I think we from the early days identified Nordstrom as like, you know, a store that really personified our brand DNA. It's just, we would go into the store, see the customers, and just like Faraday felt like the right brand for Nordstrom. So I think some of it too is how we built our product line and work. Like, Nordstrom's has been a, you know, the Nordstrom team has been a, you know, a helpful part of us, you know, growing the brand. Cause I think there's a lot of synergy between the two of us.
Now, you guys definitely put your money where your mouth is, cause you have a lifetime guarantee. Do you still do that?
We have a quality guarantee.
A quality guarantee. Okay. So talk about that.
The lifetime has been taken out.
Lifetime's a long time.
Yeah. We learned the hard way. But we stand by everything we make, and there's definitely a really good guarantee of quality. But unfortunately there's some people that it just got difficult to manage.
Yeah, I was before this, I was looking online some of the stuff you'd done, And there was a Kramer interview where you guys were talking about that. And which was really interesting. But then you also mentioned Nordstrom, which I really appreciate. So thanks for dropping our name there in the Kramer interview. That was great. But, if you think about what our promise is with our customers, it's the same thing. It's not a rule. It's just like, look, we want to make customers feel good and look their best. And we're going to stand behind what we sell. And we want to try to make it right. So is it more like that rather than a hard rule that you guys are going to use judgment and try to make sure customers are satisfied? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, we say it and, similar to the way you guys say it, is like, we want customers to have the best experience they've ever had with a brand, with Verity. So how do we, make those right decisions for the customer, invest in customer service, invest in great people to do that? Because we're huge believers in, one person who has a bad experience is, cost you 10 customers, just because of the ripple effect of not great service. And I think a lot of other brands haven't done a great job of helping customers. Then I think we have a huge opportunity.
Yeah. And I think we have one of the best customer experience teams in the country. Like, it's real people who really care. This art of hospitality, of serving people and putting the customer first, is always at the forefront of what we do.
I love it. I think that's great. So where does that bring us to? What, here you are 10 whatever years later, you got a big business here. So talk about where you are now and where you hope to take this in the future.
11 years in, Pete, this is now the ability to kind of step back and make that decision that this name is going to be on the wall forever. And this family wants to run this brand forever in some way, shape, or form. I don't know what that means, but at least this family at the table wants to. And so now kind of making decisions with that in mind. So kind of going like the opposite of the day-to-day reactive decision-making to like the decadal approach and like, what are the decisions we're making now that's actually going to affect generations or decades from now? So it's just allowed us all to be comfortable in now setting this organization up for the future. Like, I think for 10 years, we just tried to figure out how to keep the lights on. And now it's like, all right, let's go ahead and build all the internal systems of this place and the recipe of how to run our business so that people, new hires, years from now are still feeling us and feeling this brand in the same way.
That's great. Hey, I got a story for you guys. I was talking to someone in the financial world recently. I was talking about the different brands and how it works, and particularly upstart brands that start as kind of D2C and then they find a place with us. And he mentioned you guys. And one of the things that was really nice about it, he goes, and it's such, those guys are so cool. And it makes me feel cool just like being attached to it. So it was really great. Just like what your brand does and how it all permeates. It has a place for customers that they really like it. I mean, I think that's true. It seems like you have a lot of loyalty to your brand because not only is it a great product, but they buy in to the brand promise too. And you give customers a lot of reasons to be attached to it in an emotional way. So it's not just about stuff to wear. It's got more to it than that. And just hearing that guy play it back to me, he says, yeah, you've heard of this brand Verity? I said, yeah, I have. That was his example of, yeah, I know about those guys. They're pretty cool. So. Yeah,
there's if you think about the landscape of brands that have started over the last, 10 to 20 years, like, we're one of very few brands that have our name on it and that are sort of real, a real team of people that live and breathe the brand. So I think there's the buzzword authenticity, but it's really true for us because like, this is our life. We live and breathe the brand, in so many different ways that I think consumers really love that. And I think they're looking for that in brands that they support. So we sort of say that's one of our superpowers that we have is the three of us and our faces and our connection to the brand.
Yeah, it's a real competitive advantage. It's authentic and you guys have it. And I've seen the way our salespeople talk about it. And it makes a difference. If someone's on the floor and they're talking about what they're selling, there's a story behind it and it's compelling. And the product backs it up. It's good. So thanks so much for being on the podcast, you guys, all three of you. It was really fun to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Cool.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, that's the show. We're really glad you're with us on this journey, and we hope you keep listening. The easiest way to do that is to subscribe to the Norty Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please take a minute to give us a like, a share, and a review so other people can find this thing too. For more information about the show, head to Nordstrom.com/Norty Podcast or follow us on our Instagram page at the Norty Pod to stay up to date on new episodes, announcements, and more. We'd also really like to hear about your experience with Nordstrom, so if you have a story about how you've received great service or even bad service, send us an email to nordypodcast@nordstrom.com. You can even give us a call and leave a voicemail, and you may just get a chance to talk to me personally on a future episode of the show. That number is 206-594-0526. So don't be shy, drop us a line and be part of the Norty Pod. And make sure to tune in next time when we dive deep into the fascinating world of artificial intelligence.
When I want to offer a new product on our website or in our store, the first thing I have to do is I have to get that item and know about its attributes, be able to make it searchable on our website, be able to understand its price, all the information about it. Today, that work takes about 30 days. You can actually leverage AI today to look at a picture of that item and get about a 98% accuracy. And you could cut that down, honestly, to just hours.
I don't think any of us should sit here worried that technology is going to replace us in our job unless we ignore technology. If we don't embrace it, we will become obsolete.
You'll hear my conversation with Nordstrom's Chief Information and Technology Officer, Jason Morris, and our Chief Customer Officer, Ken Wurzel, as we discuss the new and exciting applications of AI at Nordstrom. So join us next time on the Norty Pod.